powered by Clint, the clinical intelligence platform. You're listening to Beyond the Chart with Stanford cardiologist, Dr. Raj Dash. Today, Raj is joined by Bethany Kalich, clinical pharmacist and U.S. cardiovascular medical director at Amgen.
Okay, welcome to the Beyond the Chart podcast. I'm Raj Dash. I'm a cardiologist at Stanford and also the co-founder of Clint, the clinical intelligence company. And really my motivation for launching this Beyond the Chart podcast is really to capture what I believe is this very seminal moment in healthcare, where this incredibly promising and burgeoning field of digital health is creating value across sort of the life cycle of disease diagnosis and management. And yet we're still not addressing some of the biggest pain points in medical care, sort of cutting across care access, care equity, and evidence-based quality of care at both the individual and population levels. So we have in our podcast a series of amazing guests, and today is no exception. We're really excited to welcome a friend and colleague of mine, Bethany Kalich, PharmD and U.S. Cardiovascular Medical Director at Amgen, to our podcast. Super excited to have you on the podcast today. Thank you, Bethany, and welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Just a little bit of your background. I'll sort of go through some of the basics in your background, but I'd love to have you share your current role and how you view what you do day to day with Amgen and why it's so important to you. So, you know, you've been at Amgen since 2018. Prior to joining Amgen, you were an assistant professor at the University of the Incarnate Word, as well as an adjunct assistant professor at UT Health San Antonio. You're a trained clinical pharmacist in both acute and critical care in cardiovascular medicine. And you really bring, I feel, this tremendous sort of blend of boots on the ground experience working and treating sick patients. We've had the pleasure of working with each other, always impressed with your leadership and focus on getting patients, particularly underserved patients, the right screening and treatments. So really, I would love to kind of hear how you describe your role and what you feel like is your mission and what you're passionate about at Amgen.
Well, thanks so much for that introduction. And as you mentioned, prior to joining Amgen, I was in the critical care unit at the University Hospital and take a critical care pharmacist and task them with setting up a PharmD clinic for complex medication management. And it really is the breeding ground for creativity to think outside of the box. And so while I started to set up this care transition plan from ICU to clinic for patients to come see me for their complex medication needs, that's when I started to recognize the gap in patient understanding and also agreement to the care plans. What I mean by that is in San Antonio, we have a very diverse population, and I would spend time both at the downtown clinic where we served a significant underserved population, but also in the medical center clinic to where we had a slightly different population there. But across the board, I started to see many of the disparities that we're seeing in the literature. I mean, we know that every 40 seconds someone has a heart attack, and we know that LDL is a top modifiable risk factor for that, but the testing rates are so low. And the testing rates are not only low across the board, but they're even worse in younger adults, in women, in Black men, and in uninsured populations. And so when I started to turn my expertise as a professor in adult learning theory that I knew with PharmD students and medical students to instead to the patient and say, how do I make sure that they understand what I actually just said? And how do I make sure that the plan that we just outlined here actually works for their lives? And then you harness that with some of the frustration I felt from trying to get the EHR to work for me instead of me work for the EHR. And this is what really just opened the aperture of my lens for, I think I can really do more to help people across the United States. And so was really excited to join Amgen, where I have been very impressed coming from clinical practice and academia into an organization that places a strong emphasis on the management of the disease, predicting the disease and attempting to prevent it. And so I'm excited to talk more today about what our bold ambition is by 2030 and what we're doing in the space of implementation science to get there.
Please do that. So what is that 2030 overall goal for all of you at Amgen? And what do you feel are the key steps to ensuring that the quality of care is able to be delivered, and that providers are sort of on the same page, clinicians on the same page as the patients are in this whole process. So,
about 2 years ago, we sat down and realized, you know, we just have this great community of clinicians around us who are truly our thought leaders and partners in how to pull through what is best for patients, because holistically at Amgen, our mission is to serve patients. And so as a cardiovascular unit, we sat down and said, what does that look like? Let's set a moonshot goal that's crazy ambitious and nobody will believe we can achieve, but we should try. And so our ambition is by 2030 to cut cardiovascular events in half. And we know that this cannot be done by us alone. This is going to take every member of the healthcare system, from a system level, from an HCP level, even from our partners in pharma, to be able to do this. But to do our part, we set some milestone goals for ourselves. And we've got a milestone set of goals coming up in 2025, where the first is we want to double the LDL testing rate, since we know that LDL is a modifiable risk factor, yet we know that only about a quarter of patients even get their LDL tested within 3 months of their MI. And this is the point in time when the guidelines say 4 to 12 weeks after titration of therapy, which ideally should have happened in hospital after the event, retest their LDL and see what the progress towards that goal is. If only 25% are having that done, no wonder we continue to see this uptrend in cardiovascular events. So that's the first milestone. The second is, once tested, how do we start to focus on getting towards the appropriate target levels? So whether that's an LDL of less than 70, an LDL of less than 55, depending on risk. The third is the focus on quality measures. And so we recognize that nationally, there is not a quality metric in place, but there's a lot that institutions can do to put their own quality care in place. And so this is where our Lattice Consortium has stepped in to say, how can we support implementation science, not only in the LDL testing and the LDL goal achievement, but also the overall quality of care in the system? And then the fourth milestone for us is ensuring appropriate access for patients. And this is access across disparate groups. As you've alluded to here, cardiovascular disease affects all genders, ages, and ethnicities, but we certainly see certain groups facing an increased burden for that. And so we've been very purposeful in paying attention to what methodologies and tools are we putting in place, and are they sure to not worsen the disparate care gaps, but perhaps also start to close those by 2030 as well.
That's amazing. And ambitious, but nevertheless achievable, I think. This aligns so well with what I've been trying to do in my own clinic at Stanford, but also with Clint. But I think that, you know, some of the past work you've done has been impressive. You did a pretty good sized project with Optum, with reaching out to patients and clinicians with information, and saw some impact there. What you are supporting and Clint is also involved with the ACC in terms of providing direct guidance at the point of care. What do you feel like is the opportunity there? What's so different about that than what you had tried in the past? And what other strategies are you hoping to kind of leverage in that goal? Let's say the 2025 goal, just the testing goal alone is a big win if you can get there. How do you see sort of these different approaches working together?
This is something that we were very purposeful about at the beginning, sitting down and trying to map out our philosophy behind how to approach this. And so I think that when we look at the literature in the space of clinical inertia, we know the standard quotation from the old reference that says it takes about 17 years for even just 14% of clinical evidence to get into care. And when we start to dissect what are some of those barriers to the adoption of evidence, there is a Venn diagram of the clinician, the patient, and the health system that play a role there. And within each of those segments, there's certainly knowledge gaps, attitudes, beliefs, preferences, and values. And so I think that there's a temptation to say, okay, well, 50% of the inertia is created by the clinician, or 30% of the inertia is created by the patient, or 20% is created by the health system. Where do we want to dial in and focus on? But last year around this time, we sat down with a group of experts and said, help us see past our blind spots. What do we need to focus on? And it was a fair call out that you've got to prime the clinician and the patient with nearly the same information at nearly the same point in time, but tailored to what it is that they need to see. And so I think that the Optum project that you mentioned is a great example of attempting to do that. It admittedly in the time of COVID. And so it certainly had its own challenges that I think if repeated today would not have necessarily been there. But we saw a great response from patients. Half of patients within 45 days had scheduled a visit to go talk to their clinician about the information they got on that flyer. So that shows the patient receptivity when they get the information that they need. Then when they got there to see the clinician had a dashboard or a checklist. I'm a big fan of the book Checklist Manifesto. It's one I read in residency, and it's revolutionized so many industries. But I think we can do better for the clinician, because I remember back to my clinical days, would I have likely had that traffic light colored flashcard in front of me for each patient visit? I don't know that I would have. And so I think that there's even learnings to take from that to say, how do we harness the power of the EHR to then give the clinician the just-in-time information and education to make informed decisions? And so I think that each step that we take in learning, okay, this is a multi-system approach, patient, system, HCP, let's support all of them. But then when we get into the methodologies and the tools, one of the things that's really guided how I've thought about a lot of the work that we've done is influenced by the Charles Duhigg book, Power of Habit. We know that to create a power of habit, there needs to be a cue, there needs to be an appropriate routine, and then there needs to be a reward, or what we call a motivation. And so that flyer to the patient saying, like, here's what you need to know about cardiovascular disease, was their cue. The routine, I think, is where we can crisp up some of the work of the EHR to help create hybrid intelligence, bring the artificial intelligence in front of the clinician intelligence, and now you've hybridized intelligence to optimize care for the patient, and then build a motivation on the back end. What is the tracking of the progress on a dashboard, or what is the motivation for the patient to continue to see incremental improvement in their care? And so this was just a way that we outlined our methodology and our philosophy for thinking about how we support implementation efforts, having moved forward from that point in time to where we are today.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the checklist manifesto as well. And it's been a motivation also behind Clint, is sort of giving the right information in a way that is motivating for that clinician in a checklist format, really, is these are the things that should be done for this patient at this moment in time. Do you, so a couple things about what you just mentioned, which is, you know, you have, let's say, a program that is across a health system, and you may know at the same time all of the different patients that could have opportunities for their care. You are trying to notify them, and you know that some of them are underrepresented, underserved. They may be of a certain ethnic minority. They could be women or older patients. And we know that they have poor outcomes, as you said, but also aren't getting the right treatments as well. And have you developed in your mind sort of a strategy to get to those populations? When you sort of think about it, there's many different things. It could be care access. It could be an affordability of care. It could be cultural. And how have you thought about those problems as you try to drill down into getting every patient to have better outcomes?
Yeah, this is something that I wrestled a lot with as a clinician. And it was certainly something that required me to sit down and say, okay, here's a strategy that I think can address multiple different groups. But when I walk into that room, I need to realize that in this playbook that I have in front of me of 20 different options, maybe only one of them is going to fit. And I can't walk in with these biases or these assumptions about what I think is going to fit best. I need to listen to the conversation. And what I mean by that is I became very aware of, because of the different cultural beliefs in the area where I was practicing, becoming sensitive to, rather than assuming what was going to work best, asking explicitly, like, what do you believe? What do you value most? What is your motivator? I think motivational interviewing was at the center of that. Now, the challenge there is that as a pharmacist in a PharmD clinic, it is structured in such a way that I get 30-minute visits, and that is not a luxury that everyone has. And so it was an opportunity for the cardiologist to say, I need you to sit down and have a longer conversation with your pharmacist. I think that there has been some change in healthcare now to where it's easier to get pharmacists into those roles and have that opportunity. But I also think that there's a chance here for AI to be able to be the next physician extender, to be able to bring in this information. Because to your point, if we have a patient who can't come in for multiple visits to be able to do these screening interviews and take in this information and do multiple iterations of the plan, what can we do via telehealth, or what can we do with some pre-mailers to get this information in from the patient before they're ever here, and then have some have AI be able to support the intake of that, the evaluation of what those opportunities might be, and then help us craft a care plan, cutting down on some of our time. I think that the other thing that I really had become sensitive to is recognizing that in the same way that I would like to do like a pre-intake for the patient to understand their values and their beliefs to craft a care plan, recognizing that they may not be able to come back each month for this. And so becoming more flexible with phone call visit follow-ups to titrate therapy or sequencing therapy to where it was, we'll just do a phone call check-in or a telehealth visit, and then I'll follow up with the next prescription, especially when it's in a disease state that has low risk and is really safe. The other thing that I really started to think about is any time that I would see a male patient come in, but was accompanied by his female counterpart, whether it be a daughter or a mother or a wife or a sister, I would use that opportunity to also ask screening questions about that female, recognizing that females are often very minimizing of our own diseases and our own risks as we care for others. And so that was just a unique opportunity to either then establish a formal relationship or at least get some lifestyle support in place that would help both of them.
That's awesome. I actually see the exact same thing in my clinic where I treat high-risk South Asian patients, and these men would come in their 40s. It's a young population, and their wives would be with them. And at the end of the visit, I'd be like, so, you know, what about you? Why aren't you being screened? And we know the data is really alarming, where in the last census data for California, the only demographic that wasn't living longer than the previous census was South Asian women. Mm-hmm. And so like, they just weren't getting care. They weren't getting screened. It's pretty terrible unless you sort of bring it up. And I love that, to hear that you were doing that. And I feel like, so the other piece is the cultural piece, right? And I feel like, you know, sometimes could there be a language barrier? Could there be just a trust factor with medical care in general? And I feel these are things that there's sort of this undercurrent of those things that is difficult to identify. And would love to get your thoughts on that and whether there are any strategies that you've thought about. I know Amgen has the RISE program, and it's impressive in terms of its efforts across therapeutic areas. Within your organization, is that something that really helps you in your efforts? Or is it more just like the osmosis of, hey, they're doing some great work in that space and we're going to innovate as well?
I mean, I think my eyes were opened. I can remember two stories from when I was in clinical practice. The first being an older gentleman who we had come in for rounds, and I had already been in the morning to talk about some medications before we did the team rounds. And when the attending was finishing up the conversation, said, okay, well, we'll make sure we get all of your medications ready. It was specifically a patient with AFib that we were going to be putting on a DOAC. He had said, oh yeah, that Girl Scout already came in selling her cookies. I'm not going to take any of them. And I thought, oh my goodness, I have so much more work to do. And so went back to sit down and understand, like, why was that the association? Why was this like an optional Girl Scout thing? And what did I need to bring in an older male student with me, because I was being seen as too young of a female like that? And so I think that this is where, like, sometimes we have to put our pride down and say, what is it that the patient needs? I think there's another example in clinic to where I just had the most resistant patient. And when I started to start to ask questions, there was an issue of trust there. There was, you just always push medications. And I said, actually, my desire is to get as many of these medications off as possible. Do you remember your first visit when we peeled off 5 non-essential medication therapies? And so really sitting down to understand, like, what is the barrier or the misperception that maybe is had, whether it be, I don't look like the person that's sitting across from me. And we like to hear things from people who look like and sound like us. It establishes that trust. And so that's where I think that the RISE team at Amgen under Jude's leadership is just doing such amazing work. I had a neighbor here in San Antonio who said to me, he said, I have high cholesterol and no one has ever spoken to me about your drug. And I said, well, when was the last time you went to your doctor? And he was like, I've been to the doctor every 6 months for the last 3 years because I'm so worried about my cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. And he was very frank. He said, I am a high up executive at our local Via Transit place. I'm a VP. He goes, but I bet it's because I'm a Black man. And it just broke my heart to think that, have I ever had that bias as a clinician where I didn't even ever think to offer this therapy? And so he had said, let me take you down to Miss Rosa's house and we're going to call a community meeting. And I'm going to be the champion that says that you are who can be trusted, but you bring the educational knowledge. And so I think that creating those opportunities to where we can identify where knowledge is needed and advocacy is needed, but it needs to come from that trusted source. So whether that be involvement in the local churches or the community centers or wherever that foot in the door is to be able to help those communities. And Jude's work with the RISE team here at Amgen is doing phenomenal work going into these communities and just listening, having listening exercises, understanding what it is that we need. And Jude actually has his own funny story about they had multiple interactions with a Black health community, and probably 5 or 6 interactions in, they said, you didn't tell us anything about this clinical trial. And Jude had said, I'm still learning you. I'm still trying to figure out like what's best for you and what you need. And so I think that not enough can be said for the work that that group is doing to truly go in, understand the community. And I'm really excited for a future opportunity that we're actually working on in-house that's not ready for prime time yet, but that tries to get to that place of how do we create pockets of communities that look and sound like one another to where the trust is going to exist. And we just supply them with the information that they need. It reminds me a lot of the barbershop study. How can we scale that?
That's fantastic. And that's exciting. Look forward to hearing about that when it launches. I think that what you're highlighting here is that a single solution is unlikely to work. You have to have the right information, but
That's
you also
right.
have to have the trust in the community, and you have to have the buy-in from the clinicians to get into sort of the right lane for patients to say, yes, I trust this. This is the right information. My clinician knows, as you said, at the right moment or the same moment, mm-hmm. They get this the right information to actually make a difference and make a change. There are biases, absolutely, and that's unfortunate, but being aware of them is the first step, and then implementing programs like the RISE program that you've mentioned and also some of your internal efforts is really exciting to kind of see that come together. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Talk about your team a little bit, your team, because I see a presence that I don't see with other life science companies, quite frankly, in terms of the amount of information that you provide, the events that you hold, the awareness campaigns. Has that been gratifying for you? Is that something that, how are you thinking that will expand? I think it's awesome. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I honestly have to say that it takes a village to pull all of this off. And so where my weaknesses exist, the team is really excellent about bringing in strength. And what I mean by that is my weaknesses, I have for much of my life followed the mantra of work silently and let success be your noise. And so we'll get 10 years down the road and now it's all of a sudden, oh, you did this great thing. We had no idea you were even working on this. And so our marketing partners and our corporate affairs partners and our advocacy partners are just excellent in their experience of knowing exactly what these points in time are to be able to bring awareness to, okay, not only here is this thing that we're doing, but actually we want to do it with you. We want to do it with others in the community in creating a movement. And so the first step to that was to develop this bold ambition and to put these milestones in place. And then it was to invite others together and say, this is what we think will work. Let us know what you think. And this is when the AHA and the ACC and the NLA said, you'll never do it by 2030, but we applaud you for even trying. And the ambition, and that is what they said. They said, we want on board with this, because even if it doesn't succeed, it's going to go somewhere. Yeah. And so by having a community that says, like, we're on this journey with you, it has made it so much more possible to be able to say, okay, where's the next gap? Is it in patient understanding? Let's do this education and this awareness campaign. Let's do some social media listening. We realize that, like, the trigger of aim low really resonates with many communities. So how do we associate LDL and have this hashtag aim low campaign? We recognize that testing is a gap. So let's put a solution for testing in place with whatsmyldl.com. And so all of the kudos for that goes to our really strong corporate affairs and advocacy and marketing team, which really paves the way then for medical to be able to come in and say, we do have the solutions now that these relationships are in place and that we have this eagerness. We have the solutions through the implementation consortium, which it's the leading awareness to action through implementation of cardiometabolic efforts, which is a mouthful. So we call it LATIS Consortium for short. But we call it LATICE because it truly is a desire to integrate and have these networks to where a system over here might have this great new and novel idea, but let's pair you up front with other centers who also want to do the same so scale can be achieved quickly rather than waiting the 18 to 36 months. Or the number of proposals I get each week for funding or project support. And for me to be able to say, this is a great idea, and I'm so glad your institution is interested in it. Let me connect you with our health IT team or one of these project owners who's already built the solution. And you now might have a 9-month lead runway to be able to start adopting it into your own institution. And so I think that the noise and the awareness that's been created around the ambition and the opportunities and inviting everyone to participate and be very inclusive and collective and say, like, this is going to be a journey that takes everyone is really what has set us on this path to say, now let's take the evidence and get it into practice faster and wider.
That's fantastic. I love that vision, and not just the vision, the execution that you guys are showing on that. There's a longstanding separation, it seems. And, you know, in the past, certainly there have been reasons for this where life science companies and health systems have certainly people have perceived them as having very different incentives. But what you're describing are really very collaborative relationships that you have with health systems to improve patient outcomes. And in some ways, and I don't know how well this is all fleshed out for every disease state, but when you think about total cost of care and outcomes-based sort of focus and value-based care, really. Do you feel that's where these kinds of partnerships should gravitate towards to bring down the cost of care, improve the outcomes by adopting what we know works for patients? And how do you feel like the partnerships with health systems has gone for Amgen, but also just across the industry? Like, what are you seeing from your perspective?
Yeah, this goes back to, I think, in the same way that I have I had in clinical practice approached walking through the door into the clinic with the patient. Like, I have this playbook of options that might be available, but let me let them choose what works best for them. I can speak to what certainly resonated best at UT in San Antonio, and then also my time at UNC and Duke in training, but being very large academic medical centers and a bit of two different flavors there, it allows me to bring the perspective of, okay, the pain points in those organizations were care teams and building out the care teams and fleshing out how we integrate patients to improve patient satisfaction in those locations. And so that driver and that motivation being what has built out the proposal there versus some of the other health systems that we work with. Yes, the top focus is total cost of care or care offset. Or cost of care offset. And so then building out a framework that says, okay, here's the solution that we have supported at other organizations that might work for you. We're happy to support this. Or if you have another idea that works for your organization, tell us about it and let's see what we can do to either put a collaborative value-based partnership in place or to support you in whatever way you're looking for that support. And so I think it's a very individualized approach that we have attempted to become very nimble to support. Whatever it is that we hear from that partner that has approached us, whether it be cost offset, whether it be reduction in hospital admissions at the 90-day point, whether it be physician satisfaction, patient satisfaction, population health data, we have slowly robustly built. And I say slowly because it took a little while to get the ball rolling at the beginning, but now we're rolling much faster a few years later. And so we're at an exciting point to where we just have a menu of multiple options available for people to potentially choose from, which is why next week I'm very excited. We are launching the latticeconsortium.com website to where people can go to and find many of these tools and download. And if what they need is not there, then they can contact us and we can have further discussions about what they're looking for.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Just really helping patients directly is the dream, right? And that you really are delivering on that. And you've already done this with Optum, but it is kind of the third rail of talking about like the payer in all of this, but I don't see why it's not aligned, right? There can be alignment here with health systems, life science companies, and payers. Can you speak to your view on that? Is that something that you think is real and, you know, are hoping to achieve more of at least?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it helped being having had my clinical background to come in and say, okay, here's how the relationship between a health system and a life science company can work and how we can break down some of those perceived barriers of misalignment of values and misalignment of goals. And I think that Optum is one example of that. And we have work in progress with several others that we're excited to share soon. But it goes to that same principle of what is it that that organization is looking to address and how can we partner alongside them to be the best partners possible to address whatever it is that is being sought after. So in the Optum example, it was that those pod relationships between the patient and the clinician that's currently running now. And we're excited to reveal the results of the Optum 2.0 project very soon. But I think that whether it be national payers or regional payers, we're working with both to just craft specifically what are the tools and what are the solves that we can put in place in those organizations to work together. And I've been very encouraged by the progress that's seen there. And so as part of the CV leadership ambition that we set 2 years ago, we've been hosting these regional roundtables. And so we go into, we've done one in Boston, we just did one last week in New York. And so we've brought the clinician to the table, we've brought the health system C-suite champions to the table, and we've brought regional payers to the table in some instances and national payers to the table in others. And the energy in the room and the enthusiasm is just so robust because the HCP and the health system sitting down with the payer has said, we've never had such robust direct conversations with the HCP and the health system. And Amgen, thank you for making this possible. And we oftentimes are more of a silent listener, but we're picking up on those context clues of, okay, are they going to be able to run with this together? And if not, what can we do to kind of mold and help support so that they can move on? So those regional roundtables we have found have been really successful and we're excited to have more of them.
That is very cool. I love hearing that because, you know, we've at Clint, we've worked with payers before and I've had a chance to see their internal guidelines about how they actually approve care and they are not the medical guidelines that we follow as clinicians,
right.
They are definitely different and they are probably based on different kinds of analyses, which, you know, are to their interest, but also they may just not fully grasp the impact that they could have. And so I'm hoping with some of those unique conversations that you're creating, that you can maybe shift to a more guideline, sort of medical guideline based evidence-based approach with how they also view the problem in their own sort of policies. I don't know if you've ever come across that, but it's definitely something I've noticed. What have you seen any of that movement?
100%. I mean, It makes me smirk because we have had just over my time in this role, I've had multiple conversations with the big key payer players and sitting down to look at those guidelines and say, those are the 2013 guidelines. We're in 2023. And imagine the impact that this is having on population health. And it's so nice to be able to just ladder back to, okay, let's just focus on testing. Like it's not, your post-MI patient is not a one-year follow-up. Your post-MI patient is an every 3 months until you get them to their target. Let's build that in and bring them back with automation. I mean, we've even had conversations with the lab diagnostic organizations about this nationally, about how do you build the guidelines into the testing to help pull that patient back in time to get retested. I smirk a little bit because at one point we did walk into a payer conversation meeting where the guidelines were, or their guidelines that they were following, were very outdated or had some misinterpretations, because I think that the shift between 2013 and 2018 was challenging for some. But one of them was a former student of mine. And so it was just a very interesting conversation of, oh my goodness, Dr. Kolick taught me about hypertension and lipids, and now we're having this conversation about correcting the guidelines. And so it's also been a little bit of fun to realize, like, you know, we can do a lot to adjust how these guidelines are applied by patients, by clinicians, by the health system organizations, but then also by the payers. And it takes work to open eyes and create the awareness and to build that trust that it's, this is not pharma trying to push their drug. This is a medical director trying to get to the heart of, no, this is what the latest evidence says that we should be doing. And so we've had progress there, but it's not been easy by any means.
Wow. No, that's really interesting that you've seen some of the same things and are working to improve that. That's amazing. So I wanted to kind of get to one of the final questions that is really a more of a pie in the sky, aspirational, but actually things that you're working on right now might be on track with that. But as far as how healthcare will look in 10 years, as far as whether it's the partnerships that you're developing or whether it's the workflow that you see at the point of care or both, what is your ideal and where do you see that? How close are we to that in 10 years from now, given the fact that you have a 2030 objective for this initiative within Amgen? Is that the end point, or where do you see it going after that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll start from the end and then go backwards. So 2030 is certainly the ambition that we have put in place. Now, as we continue, we have a very rich and robust pipeline. As that pipeline continues to mature, we will certainly also mature that ambition and start to continue to set higher and higher goals for ourselves. So that certainly is not static. And we're excited to see, based off of what we think is achievable in population health and also with what we can contribute with our therapies, where to move that ambition as we start to look out past the 10-year mark. I think in terms of pie in the sky, where I hope that we can get, you know, I think back to my early time as a clinician, and when I was still practicing, when there were handwritten prescriptions, and as we started to make the move from handwritten prescriptions to electronically transcribed prescriptions, it was painful. It was not easy. There were a lot of bumps in the road. But now it's a point of the past that is not as painful. Our memory has forgotten a little bit of that pain. But the benefits that we've seen in the reduction in errors and the harm reduction and the reduction in diversion of therapies has been really impressive. And so as I sit here in 2024, my hope is that we're at an inflection point in the same way with technology for what we can do with artificial intelligence. I think that, as I mentioned previously, my hope is that we get to this hybrid intelligence, to where we can have natural language processing able to support the intake of information from a patient that then builds out perhaps a personalized care plan. We've already got opportunities with some smart sets inside of the EHRs. And so then I think that the work that Clint is doing to be able to say, let's take this 95-page document of a set of guidelines and translate it into something that actually means something helpful to the clinician at the point of the visit. And so I think everything from Predictive modeling for patients based off of the data that we have in the system. I think some of the deep learning algorithms, we're going to have to pay a little bit of attention to the biases that are created from the data that's already there. But I think that we'll get to a place to where this unbiased approach to care at the point of care for the clinician to be supported, and think of it as like a two-way screen. The clinician's got a visual for what works, what they need to know. The patient's got the visual for what they need to know. And everybody walks out of that room knowing what the plan is, but then the patient has some sort of AI support as the physician extender for that next 30 to 90 to 180 days until they come back to see the clinician. I think that we see a lot of good AI in the entertainment industry. I think of like my music recommendations and my show recommendations and my book recommendations on Audible. I really hope that we start to get to that place for healthcare as well. And so that's what I would really envision for the next 10 years as my pie in the sky vision.
That's fantastic. I love that vision. And I think we are going in that direction. And I, as you said already, and perhaps even beyond just that objective look, the personalization of who is this patient? Is the real world evidence supporting this
specifically them
for this particular patient? Have patients like them responded in a positive way, or maybe they've had a higher rate of this side effect than another patient with similar numbers, but just a different demographic? And so these are the kinds of things I feel like the FDA is right at that edge, and they don't know what to do yet, but they are hoping to get some guidance. And this is the kind of work that will hopefully bring confidence to that approach.
100%. And I think that you're spot on about that personalized approach, because ultimately the goal here is to restore the human connection. We are the human clinician who can relate to the human patient. Let's let the technology release some of that cognitive burden from us.
Well, Bethany, I really appreciate your time today. It's been enlightening and exciting to hear about your vision and all of the great things that you're doing at Amgen. Congratulations. Really looking forward to continuing working together, of course, but hearing and seeing all of the great things that you're doing beyond in healthcare. So thank you so much for joining today. And for our listeners and viewers, you can catch the Beyond the Charts podcast online, and there'll be information for you to access all of our interviews as they are being published. Thank you, Bethany.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.